From the Center for the Study and Teaching of Writing, this is Writer's Talk. I'm Doug Dangler. Erin McGraw, professor of creative writing at Ohio State University, is the author of five books, including Good Life, Lies of the Saints, and her latest, The Seamstress of Hollywood Boulevard. Welcome, Erin, to the Writer's Talk studios.
Thank you. It's good to be here.
Great. Let's start with your most recently published book, The Seamstress of Hollywood Boulevard. Mm-hmm. This follows 20-plus years in the life of its heroine, Nell Presser, mm-hmm. and it takes place from around 1900 to 1924.
That's right.
What was your elevator talk while you were writing this book? What was your short way of describing it?
I'm writing a book based on the life of my scandalous grandmother.
Oh, good. I was hoping that you would invoke the word scandalous,
yep.
because there are some of the actions in here are scandalous
yep.
for the
oh, yeah.
time. They're pretty much what everyone does now. But
oh, yeah.
everyone who's having a lot of fun, who's not old and married. But so how did you explain it after that part? What was your more detailed talk?
I hate to give away all of the turns in this thing, but mm-hmm. the initial scandal was that she ran away from her family. She abandoned her children.
Mm-hmm. And so without giving away what happens in the book,
yeah.
Are the things that happened in the book really reflective of... The life, how much creative license could you take with it?
Quite a bit. The first part of the book stays pretty true to my grandmother's experience, mm-hmm. and then, but she did wind up in California making her living as a seamstress, but she didn't work in Hollywood, even though she was there during that very glamorous time, mm-hmm. and she didn't go on to have some of the adventures that occur to my character Nell in the second part of the book,
mm-hmm.
and in fact, the end of her life wound up being very quiet and kind of sad, so that didn't make good novel material.
Right, yeah, it's only the painful parts that you bring back
there you
up
go.
That are good. Now, you say in the epilogue that you learned about, based this on mm-hmm. a lot of the stories that your parents had mm-hmm. told you about your grandmother. You never got to meet her.
Oh, I did.
Oh, you
I did?
Did,
yeah.
Okay.
We didn't talk about those early days, ever, mm-hmm. ever. She would come to our house for holidays, you know, and I remember her as a kind of quiet presence, chain-smoking and drinking bourbon in the living room while my mother and I were making Thanksgiving dinner.
So a traditional grandmotherly figure.
Who had no interest in children, just none.
Mm-hmm.
If I could have an adult conversation with her, she was interested. And mm-hmm. otherwise, she was not about to ask what happened at school that day.
Okay. So was your... The part about the child abandonment,
mm-hmm.
Was your mom one of those?
Or? No, actually it was my father's mother, but
okay.
I wrote him out of the book, I'm afraid. He messed up my pattern, and so he didn't wind up in the book.
Okay, so there are the pattern of women working mm-hmm. with or against women in the book.
That's right.
Which is fairly clear, because I think almost all of the important characters are, most of them seemed to be women in it. I mean, there were a couple of other characters. She works for somebody who's a woman who's got a big influence on her,
mm-hmm.
Sort of not a positive influence, ultimately. But some of the other people are come in and out of the story are men. I was waiting for her husband
mm-hmm.
from the first part of the book
uh-huh.
to make a return.
You know, I always kind of wondered, but he seemed perfectly content for her to be gone away, and mm-hmm. nobody knows what happened to him.
Oh, really?
He might very well have divorced her because he had grounds, but things were fairly slipshod. They were out there in the prairie. It was the very mm-hmm. beginning of the 20th century. There weren't a lot of records being kept.
Right. I was thinking that as I read through this book that I've actually made a comment to somebody. There were no databases
right.
in 1900. Nobody would know. How would you find out if somebody married a second time?
Mm-hmm.
You know, you'd have to go to that courthouse.
That's what you would do.
And it reminded me of the scene in with Jack Nicholas in... sorry, Jack Nicholson. We're in Columbus, so I'll say it was Jack yeah. Nichols. Chinatown, where
uh-huh.
he goes to the records store office and
uh-huh.
starts ripping things out of books and
yep.
coughing
yep.
to cover it. That's how you would get out of being married to somebody previously. So how did you work out the character then? What led you through knowing your grandmother? Where did you start to veer from it? What did you think was fair or not fair? Or is it just, I'm going to take this clay from my childhood and mold it in whatever ways that work best for the novel?
That's... a complicated question. I knew that the beginning of my grandmother's life was just a really good story. I've been mm-hmm. telling it at dinner parties all my life. It's a good story. So that part, just in terms of narrative, I knew I didn't need to mess with. And I also knew that there was a drastic falling off after mm-hmm. around 1930 in real life, and that was where I would have to meddle. So just the editorial part of my brain understood that much. In terms of where I made a character who's different from the grandmother that I knew, and that kind of came from language itself. I had in my mind a certain kind of voice that I was going for, and the voice was tough and self-aware and kind of funny, mm-hmm. and that defined the character.
Mm-hmm. You know, it reminded me also as I was reading it, the voice of the character is not... not the sort of warm and fuzzy kind of character. No, and it reminded me of Nellie on Little House on the Prairie, because they're sort of contemporary. And Nellie, you know, she's not nearly as spoiled or anything as Nellie, but she had that same sort of, you know, I'm very independent and mm-hmm. I'm going to be doing what I want to do, which includes, you know, eventually leaving mm-hmm. The one person. Although, as you describe the marriage, you can certainly see that either of them might have had grounds to.
Well, yeah, I don't cast any blame here. I think that this is a very realistic portrait of a certain kind of marriage in a certain time and place. That being said, I had to figure out a way to make a reader understand why a woman would do something like this. Mm-hmm. And she isn't a monster. She's just trying to save her own life.
And you know, I felt funny about it because as I was reading it, I didn't... I fell into the sway of the narrator enough that it wasn't until somebody else said, what a monstrous thing to do to leave your children, because you recognize, you know it's sort of coming, and it didn't occur to me as a monstrous thing. I'm
good.
Like, well, you know, that'd be kind of an awful life. And as you say at some point that Kansas comes in for a bit of abuse in the book, and so I didn't even think about that because I was just following the narrator through. Did your parents read the book?
Yeah, they did.
And what did they think about your takeoff on your grandmother's story?
Well, they both have been wonderfully supportive, just mm-hmm. tremendously. They've been great. My father was out of his mind with excitement that I was writing this book, and he didn't care a bit that I was hanging out fairly unseemly family laundry. Mm-hmm. He was really excited about it, and he died 2 days before the book officially came out. Mm-hmm. He was 88 years old. And he'd read it twice, once in manuscript, once in galleys. But that was hard. That was hard that I wasn't able to put a copy of the book in his hands. But I have gotten kind of messianic about it, partly as a result of that. And when I give readings, I start out with a shout out to my dad.
Okay. Well, that's great. What was the reaction to the character? He liked the book. Did he say, you really captured my mother in the beginning, or this isn't anything like her?
He didn't bother to say this isn't anything like her. We all knew this was not. This was somebody that I made up. Mm-hmm. But he didn't hold it against me that I wrote him out of the book, which I thought was handsome of him.
Okay.
And he said I got the details right. That was worth a lot.
Right. Because there are a lot of details in this book that I imagine required a lot of research, unless you were, you know, you came into the world knowing about textiles, sewing, Hollywood in the 1920s. What kind of research did you have to do for this?
Less than you think. But... Before I got to serious writing, I read a couple of books, sociology books mostly, about the period so I could get a feel for what was going on culturally. And then after that, an awful lot of it I just did ad hoc. I mm-hmm. would stumble up against a detail that I needed right that minute in that scene, and I'd go and look it up. And so I spent a whole lot of time, a whole lot of my writing time, mm-hmm. wandering around the web trying to find out what year paved surfaces came to Kansas, you know, mm-hmm. stuff like that.
So you didn't learn to sew.
I did not learn to sew.
That's too bad. Because you hope that everybody, I always assume that an author walks away from a book with some new skill, right, that you've researched and maybe done. Your next book will be on boating. Tell me about your writing habits or processes. Uh-huh. You are a member of a two-person writing household, two-writer household.
I am.
And I think it's reasonable to say that which one of you, I want you to tell me which one of you is better and why your writing and writing habits are better than the other person, who I'll let you name if you want, but that's up to you.
I know that before we began this interview, I was saying that I was the better writer, but I'm not going to say that on camera. But, my husband is Andrew Hudgens. He's a poet, and poetry right out of the gate calls for different kinds of writing habits. Prose writers really need to just sit in the chair and make one sentence follow another. Mm-hmm. And the energy of poetry is a lot more up and down. And so I tend to be at the desk by 7:30, and if it's a teaching day, I'm usually done by 11 because I have to be in to teach. Mm-hmm. And that's my writing time every day. And mm-hmm. I knock off on Sundays.
Okay.
And he is much more up and down and up and down and up and down all day long. He's like a flea.
Okay. So the comparison is you're the worker and he's the flea. So that I think works well. That there's nothing dismissive about that. As a when you're a creative writing professor, as you mm-hmm. are, when this book, what did you take away from it that you took back to your students and said, here's something that, having written this new book, that I really want you to think about as you're writing?
One of the things that was such a gift in writing this book was climbing into the mind of a character who was born at the end of the 19th century and shaped by that community. She would have no concept of all of the ideas of Freud. The idea of a subconscious and everything that we take for granted with that would not exist for her. And that was so interesting and so much fun and such a wonderful way to think about the world in a different kind of screen. And so to answer your question specifically, allow the habits of your character to inform you. Learn from the characters. Because it'll give you a whole new way of looking at the world.
In this case, does that mean sort of rejecting Freud or coming to a different sort of understanding?
What does the world look like if you don't have the concept of the subconscious, of mm-hmm. being driven by desires and motivations that you don't necessarily ever even see or comprehend? Mm-hmm. If you take that whole idea out of your mind, life becomes very different. Mm-hmm. Not less complicated, not less intelligent, but different.
Mm-hmm. You know, not to get myself into trouble with creative writers, but
I
wonder.
You're in trouble.
But yeah, I know already. But that seems to me like for someone who writes, it's a compulsion. You know, for a lot of people, describe it as this is what I do, mm-hmm. this is who I am, mm-hmm. and so there's. I'm curious about. When you are a creative writer, what sort of delving into subconsciousness is good mm-hmm. for you, and what is bad for you? If you can figure out why you want to write, because you want to get back at whoever was mean to you in junior high, not that that's why I do it, but if that, and I'm not a creative writer, so this is a question that's not really on mind. But is that, what is your take on that? Is that something that's healthy for creative writers or not healthy?
I think it's, it kind of doesn't matter if it's not healthy. It's very human, and it's going to mm-hmm. be there no matter what. We've got all kinds of desires that bring us to trying to put words on the page. Mm-hmm. And some of them are useful and some of them are not very useful. But all of those initial ones get burned off. It's like, that's the first flare of the rocket going up. All that initial energy gets burned up really fast. And then we move to a different kind of motivation, a deeper mm-hmm. one. And it's generally quieter and more private and more fruitful.
You know, one of the interviews that we've done with Donald Ray Pollack, mm-hmm. I think you know, he said that to be a writer, one of the first things he had to do was train himself to sit in a chair
yeah.
for a long time. And I thought that was great advice, because even now that's not something that I can do.
There's nothing like spending, let's say a half an hour or so working on a scene to make you suddenly realize the top of the refrigerator needs dusting.
Mm-hmm.
Right this minute.
Or there's laundry to be done.
There's laundry
even if
to
you
be
did
done.
It yesterday,
right.
there's mm-hmm. some that you wore then mm-hmm. that might have to be redone. Tell me about getting a book deal, mm-hmm. any of the books that you've written. What advice do you have for aspiring writers?
Golly, have a good idea. the deal with this was the second part of a two-book deal that I had with Houghton Mifflin, now Houghton Mifflin Harcourt. And I had already sold them a book of short stories, The Good Life, and they were looking for an idea for a second book. That's all, just an idea. Mm-hmm. And I ran through a couple of things, and my editor quite rightly rejected them. Well, they were not good. And the only thing I had left in my brain was this idea I've been carrying around for years of writing my grandmother's story. And so I started hesitantly to explain what it was, and she immediately saw that it was just a really good story.
Well, it also ends on an ambiguous note, a note of, in some ways, escape.
Yeah.
Literally and perhaps figuratively. That means sequel. The Seamstress of Hollywood Boulevard, part two. Yeah. Is there something else that, now that you've had this character, there's nothing else in mind? She doesn't go on to, okay, be part of the 30s,
no.
Go through the Depression.
No.
Yeah, I tried. What's the best part about being a writer? What's your favorite part?
Going to work in your pajamas.
Okay. So all those ads for going to school in your pajamas, like for Columbus State with online education, resonate strongly with
deeply
you.
With me.
Deeply
yeah.
with you.
Yeah.
So you'll be teaching the online creative writing classes at OSU soon. What's the worst part? What's the hardest part?
In the end, it's you and your love for the work, and that's it. There's no guarantee that the world's going to love it or is going to care if you ever write another word. Mm-hmm. And there's really nobody... There's no teacher or mom out there saying, do your work. The editor, in the end, if you don't do it, is just not going to care all that much.
What I'm curious, another thing about the editor, what kind of relationship do you have? What you said that they rejected this anonymous person. You can name. but what, you know, when you they reject them quickly like that, how many times do you just keep going back to the same well? You said this was your last idea, but how else does that impact your writing? You know, they must have said at certain times, I'm guessing, I don't like this.
Sure.
Think this is bad. What kind of negotiation do you carry out with an editor?
If we're just talking about the development of a storyline in a book, and so if the editor is to say, I don't like what you're proposing happens at this section, the proposed love affair, let's say, then it's just an issue of figuring out what the problem is and how else it might be addressed. Mm-hmm. And often I've had the experience with editors and agents that they propose a solution that I don't like, but I can see what it is they're going for. And so I just find an alternative way to get to it that we can all agree on, that we all like.
Has that worked out well?
Yeah.
Or
okay. Yeah.
They don't see through it occasionally and say, oh, I see, you're just trying to avoid what I want.
The idea isn't that it's give me what I want. This is not like Hollywood script doctoring. It's much more along the lines of, I don't like what's here, what about this? And I can say, well, what about this? Because for whatever reason, what's there isn't working.
Okay.
So it's a good idea not to love your work too terribly much.
Okay, don't get too attached to
Nell. Don't get too attached, yeah.
Because she could be taken apart at any time and put back together.
Yeah, and you yourself might be the one to do that. If you sit there and say, there's something bugging me about, again, whatever, chapter 6, and you look at it and look at it and slowly realize the reason you don't like chapter 6 is that it's completely wrong from the ground up. It's just wrong, 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 and you got to redo it. That often happens. It's a good idea not to love it too much.
Do you then not go back to your books later because you might have that reaction? Or is it now that it's done, you're not going to worry about it?
Now that it's done, I'm not going to worry about it.
Okay. That's probably the healthiest way.
Well, it's done. I'm not going to rewrite it.
Well, you've got two copies here. You can change part of this right here. What's the best writing job you've had, or what was your favorite book to write?
This was my favorite book to write, no question. I loved doing the historical work. I loved immersing myself in the period. I love learning about sewing, even though my vision is too bad and I can't do it. I really liked being lost in this world. I liked it a lot.
Mm-hmm. You know, it's funny because one of the things that I thought as reading it was... sewing machines make a number of appearances, stand-ins for many other things, but the first time the sewing machine is mentioned, I actually thought, wow, you know, would they have a sewing machine? A dirt poor family in Kansas in 1890, would they have a sewing machine? Mm-hmm. And they must have.
Yeah.
But it was a sort of a surprising thing to think about because it put me in mind of my grandmother's old sewing machine with the treadle at the bottom that went like this.
Uh-huh.
And at some point that was suggested by, I think, my father, mm-hmm. After my grandmother's death, that she could have it. Mm-hmm. And I, in contrast to your character being very excited about it, I recall her suggestion to him that I really can't respond about the sewing machine. So it was an interesting thinking about the mechanics of the mm-hmm. story and mm-hmm. the research. What's the worst writing job you've had? What's the one you were happiest to be done with?
I was working as a very, very low-level copy editor for Los Angeles Magazine right after I graduated from college, and I was sent out to do interviews, little thumbnail, like people watch kinds of mm-hmm. interviews, and I interviewed Marlon Brando's sister. Mm. That was right down there in the list of things I did not enjoy and did not want to do.
What was wrong with Marlon Brando's sister?
Well, she had agreed to be interviewed because she had just come out with a book and she wanted to talk about the book. Marlon Brando's sister was huge. She was the size of a Zeppelin. And the only thing that the people at Los Angeles Magazine wanted me to talk about was to make snarky comments about moo-moos and how she was spilling out the sides of her chair. And I was caught in the middle between these two factions, and nobody was happy with the copy that I wrote. So finally,
okay, well, at least nobody was happy. That's a sign of really going down the middle. So what led you away from a life of aiding paparazzi? How did you decide?
That partly. I was young and snooty and much too artistic for mm-hmm. crass journalism. And the idea of the necessity of paychecks hadn't yet really made it into my mind.
Okay. So if you weren't a writer, what's your fallback career?
Sales.
Sales?
Yeah.
And why?
I can't sew, but I really like clothes, okay. despite the fact that I write in my PJs. I like retail. I've done it. I enjoy mm-hmm. it. I have a good time with it. I like people.
Okay. That's unusual for a writer. I think that must be sort of odd that, you know, most people... I don't think most writers suggest that they like people, that they like to observe, dissect, mm-hmm. describe. Mm-hmm. But interaction doesn't always seem to be the number one thing.
You know, a really good way to observe, dissect, and describe... Talk to them.
Talk to them. Interact.
You find stuff out that way.
Okay.
Yeah, just wait till tomorrow, Doug. Wait till you see what I start writing.
Right, great, yeah. Do you have a blog?
I wouldn't tell you at this point if I did, but no, I don't.
Okay. What genre haven't you written that you'd like to try? Speaking of blogs.
Honestly, horror.
Really?
But, yeah.
Are you a Stephen King fan?
Not so much. Okay. Sometimes there are a few of them I am, but not so much. But I admire good horror fiction. It has to be intelligent because there are so many great big yawning chasms of cliche that have to be avoided. Mm-hmm. And I like writing about characters at heightened states of emotion.
Okay. Does that extend to horror movies? I'm curious.
No.
No.
Because by and large they are so bad.
Right, right.
And they're so darn dumb.
Okay. Well, we should have you on for the Halloween version, and you could read your favorite horror fiction.
Sure.
What's on your nightstand right now? Who are you reading?
Right at this moment, it's F. Scott Fitzgerald. It's on my nightstand because I'm getting ready to teach a seminar in Forms of the Novel, and you know, I've got Tender as the Night as one of the assigned texts, so... Okay. They're reading it, and I'm reading it.
Is Fitzgerald a big influence of yours, or who are your big influences?
I wish he were a big influence because I so admire the elegance of his prose, but I tend not to move in that direction. I admire his work very much, but you know, he's probably not so much of an influence. I'm afraid that Flannery O'Connor, the great mid-20th century short story writer, is so much of an influence that it's altogether too evident.
I didn't see the misfit in this one at all.
Yeah. You just weren't looking.
I wasn't. Well, yeah. It might have been the first husband. I don't know.
And so certainly she's very, very present in just the way I put sentences together. Also, another mid-20th century writer, Bernard Malamud, is on my mind a lot and is real present in my thinking.
Okay. What's your secret vice of an author or a genre, since we've already mentioned horror fiction?
Yeah,
what would surprise your readers to know that you read?
This one is horror of a different category, J.D. Salinger.
Really?
And particularly the J.D. Salinger of Raise High the Roof Beam Carpenters, who's just so drippy and self-indulgent, I can hardly even stand it, but he is so what he is in that book, and I would not recommend him to anybody. It's just...
But you keep going back sort of masochistically.
There's something there that it's a little like the once-a-year binge on when you buy the five-pound bag of mini Snickers bars and eat them all in one sitting.
That should be done only once a year?
I thought you knew that.
No, I didn't know that.
That's
no
a once-a-year event.
I thought that was a weekly thing.
And then you feel absolutely vile the next day. That also goes along with
right. Yeah, well, I think that's part of being born and raised in the Midwest. You know, you're supposed to...
I wasn't.
That. Right, okay, that's... Right, because the character ends up in California.
Yeah.
Well, again, the book is from Erin McGraw. It is The Seamstress of Hollywood Boulevard, and there are many other books available. And I want to thank you very much for coming in, talking to us today, and we look forward to your next book. Do you have the next book in mind, or is this...
No, I wish I did. I'm, as they say in Hollywood, between movies.
Okay, well, you should write it about a well-meaning but poorly paid interviewer. At a large Midwestern university, something like that. I understand they're fascinating, but not enough books have been written on that genre.
I like this. I'll move with it.
Well, thank you very much.
My pleasure, Doug. Thanks.